All right. Okay, so this next session, can you hit that door behind you there? So this next session, the hardest thing about this session was coming up with the right name for it, okay? And I'm convinced that most common WCF usage configurations is not really the right name. This session is kind of an advanced follow-up to what I just finished. And it's the first time I'm giving it, so nobody here, I should have tested you. I should have said who's seen this before, just as he was being honest with me. So it's the first time that I'm giving it, so I'm hoping that the timings work out. I wrote it specifically for this event. And I'm hoping that we can do it all in good time. If we go 5 minutes into lunch, I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. What the session is all those little characteristics that I showed you at the end of the last session, I want to show you some of the most commonly used ones and the most important ones. And at the same time, teach you how to do some configuration besides just setting up a host and an endpoint. Because I showed you all the minimums, but there are some additional things that you may want to know about where the defaults just aren't a good idea, and that's the purpose of this session here. Everybody knows who I am here? All right, so we're going to talk about the flexibility and the configuration ability that WCF gives you. We're going to cover that briefly, and then we're going to get into two different types of configuration, the configurations at a binding level and the configurations at a service level. These are referred to as binding configuration and service behaviors, or just behaviors, okay? And the examples that I have for you are in the topics of debugging, instancing, concurrency, transactions, not security. Security is an example here, and I have a slide at the end that talks about it, but I'm afraid I don't have much more on security for you because it's just way too big a topic. So I have to do an official CYA statement, right? This is designed to give you an understanding of this material, and I want to point out that I spent a whole day describing this stuff in my classes, okay? So this is the most commonly used, most common usage of the material in what I would recommend as the first approach to do this and then do it differently if you need to. But always start out the way I'm going to show you. That's what this session is designed, okay? And for further reading on this stuff, I give you all the references at the end. So WCF allows you to configure things at the binding level. Now think about what the binding is. The binding is the transport. It's the method of communication between the client and the service. Huh?
It's the house.
Right. What the hell did you say?
The how.
The how, right, okay. So binding configuration allows you to tweak characteristics of the communication. And that right there implies that it's going to have to be tweaked on both sides because the communication is the pipe in the middle, right? Service behaviors are characteristics specific to the service. So usually the client is oblivious to service behaviors. They just see the byproduct of service behaviors. Service behaviors are configured in two different ways depending on the type of behavior. You're going to see an example of both here. Instancing. Instancing determines how a service gets instanced. Now, by instantiated, I literally mean how the object that the service is comprised of gets instantiated. You know this stuff is just newing up an object when you do that in everyday programming. But right now we have a framework that does this for us, okay? The WCF runtime actually newed up the service class. Remember that regional service? It newed that up for me and served it to a client calling. How that gets newed up and what instance gets served on the next call coming in or maybe a call from another client, that can all be configured. Concurrency is that. Now, both of these are huge topics, and I just cover a little on each of them, okay, the important stuff in my opinion. I got some great diagrams for you, too. Concurrency is how WCF is going to handle the locking for you because you may want WCF to handle all the concurrency management so that you don't have to worry about it whatsoever, or you may want to do it on your own. And I'm going to show you examples and what the effects are of the different concurrency. And then we got transactions, which is a huge, huge topic, but once again, I give you the fundamentals to hit the ground running with them, okay? WCF is a transaction manager, fully and qualified, and it lets you involve your services in transactions. It also allows your services to start up transactions. And it does it in a very simple way. And then security is just, like I said, it's a really big topic. It's typically scenario-driven, meaning in an intranet scenario, do the following. In an internet scenario, do the following. There are certificates involved. Who loves working with certificates here? Who works with certificates? Okay, now, who loves? Keep your hands up. You see how everybody's hand went down? Certificates used to be my security used to be my unicorn. Everybody know what that means? Never saw Gone in 60 Seconds? Eleanor was Memphis Reigns' unicorn, you know, the horse that nobody can catch. Security was my unicorn. Now it's my bitch. So it took me a while to get there. It really did. It took me, I mean, I can now teach my whole day of security very, very comfortably. But that wasn't always the case. It was a difficult transition for me as well. So binding configurations. These set the characteristics of the transport. What this means is that it sets characteristics of the communication between the client and the service, okay? Because of this, they're set on both sides. So if you change a binding setting on the service, you have to have a matching one of the client or you will run into a problem. If you're exposing, who's the, you're right there, what was your name? Jay? Okay, so Jay was talking to me earlier before this session started about he's writing services where he can't give somebody his contract DLL because he doesn't really have access to them. He's on the other side of the world. So in that case, you're just exposing services through a URL, and it's up to the client to do an add service reference and ping your service and then have all the contracts generated for them by Visual Studio. Part of that automatic generation includes all the configuration as well, and it includes all of the configuration that I'm going to go over with you here. So when I say binding configuration needs to be done on both client and service, if you don't have access to both client and service and you do your binding configuration on the service, when somebody adds a service reference to your service, they're going to get the matching binding configuration. It comes across as metadata. It exposes metadata through your service, okay? It's set on the endpoint itself, which means the endpoint was what? A, B, C. What's A? What's B? What is C? Contract. And a service can have more than one contract, right? So if the endpoint is at the contract level, and I just told you that the binding configuration is set at the endpoint, that means that you're setting communication parameters for how that contract is handled. And part of these parameters can involve security. And this is how you would secure one contract of a service one way and another contract another way, even though it's the same service. So potential settings, and these are the ones that I'm going to talk about with the exception of security. I should just stop teasing you and take security out of all these slides. We're going to talk about session reliability, message size, and timeouts. Now, I'm able to test timeouts. Message size, I don't have anything to properly test it with, and reliability is almost impossible to test. So it's one of those things where you just have to trust that it works, okay? So those are the three examples, and in my opinion, the three things that I recommend that you're aware of. So this is the way you set binding configuration. It's actually very easy, but it's a little more configuration, as you can see. So here's our service with our endpoint. You're familiar with this already. We got A, B, and C, but then we have another setting called binding configuration. And binding configuration points to a name. This name can be anything you want as long as it's defined down here. Now, I may talk about this in an upcoming slide, and if I do, I'll just go over it. So while I have this on the screen, I'll just talk about it now, and then I'll skip it in the slide. Notice there is a commonality. It's in the bold letters, okay? This tells me that this endpoint, and it all makes logical sense, this endpoint is going to be configured with a binding configuration section called binding one. Now I got to define binding one somewhere. And binding one is defined in a binding section. And here's where it gets tricky. Inside the binding section, there are strongly typed sections, each adhering to a different type of binding. So you learned earlier about basic HTTP binding. I also mentioned NetTCP binding, and I showed you guys NetNamePipe binding. Each one of those is an actual binding name, which means you're going to find a section under each one of those binding names. So if this was a basic HTTP binding, and I'm pointing to binding one, this would actually immediately blow up because binding one would have to be included in a basic HTTP binding section. You understand what I mean? So there is no binding type equals NetTCP binding. There is literally a strongly typed tag, configuration tag, for each and every binding that WCF offers. That's why you're seeing it hard-coded as NetTCP binding, because that's what we're using here. Now, inside that hard-coded binding tag, that strongly typed binding tag, we have a binding section with a name that matches to this. And I can have as many of them as I want, because I may have 15 different endpoints, all of them NetTCP, but each one corresponds to a different contract, and I want each one configured just a little differently. Right now I'm on the server, but yes, it would be on the client and the service. Everything that I'm talking about here would be on both, the client and the service. Good question. So here's binding one, there's binding one. I may have another endpoint that points to binding two. I'd have to define a binding two down here. And then within that binding section, both in additional attributes and or internal tags, I have whatever configurations I want to change. When you add a service reference somewhere, when you don't share your contracts and you just rely on somebody giving you an address and you say add service reference and you ping the WSDL file and you add your service reference, Visual Studio will generate all your configuration for you, and it will scare the bejesus out of you because it'll generate a binding section for every single endpoint it finds on the service that you gave it, and it will have every possible attribute and value with its default setting. It's great for educational purposes, but you're going to spend a lot of time deleting your way out of that stuff. You don't have to delete it. It's perfectly valid, but it's redundant because it's the values that are in their default settings. But it's a great way for you to learn what's available to you. It's the way I learned it. I can't get over the fact that you're wearing the What Would Miguel Do shirt, man. That's awesome. All right. With me so far? So let's talk about the first potential setting here that I'm recommending, reliability, okay? Reliability can be used with two different types of binding only. It can't be used with basic HTTP, and it can be used with NamePy because it doesn't need to be used with NamePy. Reliability can only be used with NetTCP binding and WSHTTP binding, and what this does is that it enables communication retries. We all have network hiccups. It happens all the time. Sometimes Bing takes a millisecond to come up. Sometimes it takes 3 seconds to come up. Because number one, it may be routed differently through the internet around the world. Number two, it might have encountered a couple of hiccups here and there. And thanks to the ability of ACK-NACK retries, you know, acknowledge and negative acknowledge retries, we have a reliable website that we can look at the end after it retries all the time. Reliability on services give us that same functionality. So this will give us retryability behind the scenes, so that if we do have network hiccups, then it becomes more important when you're using WSHTTP binding, which gives you the potential of going around the world, as opposed to NetTCP, which keeps you in your firewall. But your firewall may go around the world because you may have multiple locations, like you guys do. So this gives you the ability to do automatic retries. And this is the one that's kind of next to impossible to test. I wouldn't begin to know how to test this. It's one of those things where Microsoft said, trust me, it works, and you just, these are the droids you're looking for, you know? Also, another feature that is available on reliability is ordering. And ordering may or may not be important to you, but you may spin off 4 different message calls, service calls, from a client, okay, really fast, just back to back, bang, 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 4 different message calls off a proxy. And they may get to the service that proxy is accessing in a completely different order. Whether or not that's important to you depends on the design of what your service is designed to do. But the reason they may get there in a different order is because every message call starts from the client and gets to the service. And then the next message call, even on an open proxy, starts at the client again. And for whatever reason, it might have taken another route around the world to get to your server in Singapore. One might have gone across the Atlantic, the other one the other direction through the Pacific. You have no control over this. So if the ordering of your messages is important, you can simply turn them on the true right here. And now the server will hang on to that as it comes in to make sure that it's in the proper order. And only when the one that knows it's supposed to go before this one gets there does it start processing the messages. How it does that, that's magic you don't have to worry about. And this is the way you would set this stuff. So once again, we got our binding, NetTCP binding. We named our binding. We have to make sure our endpoint is pointing at this binding one. And then if for this particular setting, it becomes an inner tag called reliable session. We can enable it and set order to true. Yes, sir. I haven't yet, but I will. Why is it here? Oh, but that's what reliability on. By saying enabled equals true, you're enabling a reliable session. That enables your communication retry. Oh, I'm not, I should be honest with you, I'm not really sure how many times. No. I don't know. No configuration on that. Did you have one question? Go ahead.
When you're talking about message ordering, do you mean by what time it gets to the server, or is it somehow also looking at what time it starts from the client side?
I'm sure timings are involved there, but it has to do with the order that you sent them from the client side. So if you called method A, method B, method C, ordering ensures that if method B, the call to method B gets to the service, the service see that ordering is turned on. Somehow when that proxy was instantiated, the communication line was established, it received information about the first method that was sent, that was called, and I'm not sure exactly how it does it in the background, but when it receives that call from message B, it knows that it hasn't processed one from A yet, so it waits for A to get there. So whether it uses timestamps or not, I'm not 100% sure.
I could ask you this later, but in a particular real-time transaction, when my ordering from the client really matters to me, like in that case, is there any option to enable that particular feature where client wants from one part of the world who is sending me an order, I want to make sure that this one comes to first before the second one gets started?
No, if they come from different clients,
yeah.
No, there's, yeah, okay, so is there a way to control the order, like if you're expecting a call from one client before the call from another client, that's just, that has to be handled by state in your service. Your service has to be intelligent enough to know that it can't perform this functionality because something is missing that was expected from another call. That's your, you have to do that on your own because those two calls came from two different clients. Okay, message size. This is another important one. One more question, please. Order from endpoint to endpoint in one call. Yes. No, absolutely not. Is there a reason for doing this and what? That reason, okay, so the question is there a reason for doing this in the configuration vault as opposed to doing it programmatically? Okay, that the answer to that question is the same if you were to ask, is there a reason for configuring anything in the XML file as opposed to programmatically? And that's a very valid question. There are many reasons why you would want to do all of your configuration or maybe some of your configuration programmatically instead of declaratively. And that is because you want to lock your service into this, without giving an administrator the opportunity to go into the configuration file and change that. The reason for doing it in the XML is the complete reversal. You don't want to lock it into it. You want to give the administrator the ability to go in and do all this stuff. Look at the way I was able to change from basic HTTP to name pipe in front of you. What if I didn't write that service? What if I didn't have access to that code or the hosting code? All I had access as an admin was to the app config file. I was able to do that. But if all that stuff was hard-coded and programmatically, obviously I could not. That answer your question? Okay, so another useful setting is called message size. Yeah, all the binding configuration stuff is the same on client and server. It'll blow up on you. During that call, it'll blow up. So the question is, does it have to be configured in both the client and the service? And the answer is yes. Binding configuration, both the client and the service. And if the values are different, usually, depending on the value, usually it would take the smaller of the value. So if you're setting timeouts, for example, and your service is set for a timeout of 10 minutes and your client is set for a timeout of 5 minutes, the shortest one is used. Same thing for message size. Message size defaults to 64K. But when you start returning arrays of information, and you guys are going to have to catch me during lunch and ask me about that, returning collection of data, instead of returning just city-state information, I'm maybe returning a list of city-state information, maybe all of them in the country. That may easily extend past 64K as the size of the message. But the default that Microsoft gives you is 64K. So it will blow up, and it will blow up with a very descriptive error message that tells you this message is larger. Please consider changing the binding configuration. As usual, it tells you, you know, the right parentheses is missing instead of just adding the damn right parentheses for you, right? So my advice is to just keep this as one of these configuration settings that you really want to know about up front. and consider it setting it. When you're writing services that may have the potential of returning lists of information, you may exceed that 64K. Depending on what you're returning, you may exceed it quite easily. So the way I would change this is once again through a binding configuration. But notice this one is slightly different. This one is not an inner tag. It's an attribute right off the binding tag. So some of them are one way, some of them are the other. So here it's just called max received message size, and I just set it to 1 million here, 1 meg. If I'm sending more than a meg in a message, I probably want to rethink my design. And that's that. I know it sounded funny, but that's a serious statement.
We have a question from online wanting to know if when you set reliable session ordered equals true, will that be applied to all the endpoints?
It gets applied to whatever endpoints are configured with that binding configuration. The binding configuration is named. So let me go back to this one. The binding configuration is named. In this case, it's named binding one. So I have to have an endpoint that says binding configuration equals binding one. And I can certainly have 15 different endpoints sharing the same binding configuration. So the answer to that question is whichever endpoints are pointing to that binding configuration, that's the one those settings get applied to, whether it's ordering or message size or anything else. One more question. Multiple binding configurations. Not here. Your endpoint can, okay, that's a good question. Can an endpoint point to more than one configuration? No. An endpoint has one shot at binding configuration and one shot only. Okay, transmission timeout. This one I can actually show you, okay? And I'm going to show you depending on how our time is doing. I can't show you. We have more important demos, okay? But I'm going to describe in detail what is going to happen, okay? I almost know the error message by heart because it happens to me all the time. So transmission timeout, this is about the sending of that message, the communications, okay? It can be used with any binding, so it's not limited to just TCP or net name pipe or WSHTTP. What it does is that it sets the maximum time the WCF will wait for a message to be transmitted, and the default for this is 45 seconds, if I'm not mistaken. Don, is it 45? The send timeout? I think it's 45 seconds, right? 45 or 60, but either one is probably way too long. 45 seconds is a long time to wait for something. So when it's exceeded, it throws an exception. So this can be changed, once again, in the binding configuration as an attribute of binding, not as an inner tag, and it's called send timeout, and it takes the conventional time span format. So as you can see here, I set it to 1 minute and 0 seconds. Yes. That's for the message. Not that I know of. The initial handshake, like when you first open up the proxy? No, I don't believe there is. But remember when I made the call to my services, not of it, when I brought the host down and I made the call to show you that it bombed, it bombed within, I think, like less than 5 seconds. So that's a pretty short timeout. So I would be more concerned about wanting to change a timeout if it's excessively long. That one was pretty short. I'm not aware of one that can actually. There may be one, but I'm not 100% sure. There's 55 different little settings here. So this is where, add a service reference, look at all of them, and see what they each have to offer. I don't think any one person has really used every single binding configuration out there. So this one here, if I were to change the setting from 45 to 1 second and bring down the host, it would actually make a call and almost immediately tell you that that it bombed out. So these are three good settings to know about. That's my point here. Number one, to teach you how the binding syntax works, and to show you three pretty commonly used settings that you're going to want to be aware of. With me so far? Any more questions, Matt? There is, and it's an excellent question, and I didn't have this in the slide, but the retry, the message reliability tag in the configuration has another timeout of its own in that line. that is a timeout for the retries? That's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought it up because I didn't include it there, and I made a mental note to mention it, and I completely forgot. So, yeah, it's got its own little retry timeout on there. So that, in a way, who asked me originally if there's a way to control the number of retries? So, in a way, that'll kind of take care of that scenario for you. All right. So, next up, so best practices. I have a best practice slide at the end of each of these sections, okay? My recommendation is always turn reliability to true. Nothing wrong, nothing bad can come out of having this thing retry network hiccups. And as far as ordering is concerned, I'm not going to tell you turn ordering to true because I believe there is an initial handshake call that takes place because of ordering. So there may be a little overhead there. But you have to decide if the order is important for your calls. And where I think ordering may be important is in one-way scenarios because in request response services where you're sending something to a service and returning a response, you may want to act upon that response before sending your next thing, in which way you're kind of inherently controlling your own order. But there's a way of doing one-way calls where it's kind of a fire and forget scenario, and ordering may be important to you in situations like that. So just be mindful of that and think of that kind of stuff. As far as message size, I recommend to increase it to about a meg. It doesn't hurt. It's not like it's going to reserve a meg message and always send a meg across the wire. It doesn't do that. But I just don't find the 64K is sufficient sometimes. Huh? Not that I know of. I've never read anything about that. Not that I know of. The question was, does it reserve some kind of buffer? And as far as the timeouts are concerned, I find the default ones are typically okay. That 45-second on the send timeout probably is a little excessive. I usually bring mine down to about 20 to 25 seconds, but that's a decision you have to. Every service may be different. You may have a service that is designed to take a long time doing something. Well, taking a long time doing something doesn't mean that it took a long time for the message to get there. So, you know, it's just something you have to decide on your own. I typically either leave it at default or bring it down to 25 or 30 seconds. But if you forget to do that, it's not something that's going to blow up in your face. Message size, on the other hand, can blow up in your face. And reliability can blow up in your face, provided if you're exposing services out on the general internet. All right, so we got binding configurations out of the way. Now let's talk about behaviors. Behaviors are characteristics for the service only, which means they change the way the service is going to behave. And as far as the client is concerned, the client doesn't know about this. The client just sees the byproduct of this and may react differently based on this byproduct, okay? These are characteristics of the service. They do not affect the binding. They do not affect the transport. And because they're unknown to the client, they're not configured on the client. They're only configured on the host. Now, there's two types of settings. Sometimes you get a combination of both things, as with transactions. Sometimes you only do one or the other. The two types of service behavior configuration is one at the configuration level, declaratively, inside the config file, and some of them are on an attribute level, meaning you're using the service behavior attribute to decorate your service and change some of its characteristics. So here is an example of service behavior, and the pattern is nearly identical, okay? The difference here is the behavior configuration, unlike the word binding configuration, it's called behavior configuration now, is at the service level, not at the endpoint level. Endpoint implies transport. Service for service only, not on the client. So you got behavior configuration equals some name, and then, of course, that's got to match up with some definition somewhere. And that definition now, instead of in a binding section, it's in a behavior section. And there's two types of behaviors. There's service behaviors and there's endpoint behaviors. And I'm not here to cover endpoint behaviors. Not too important for our purposes. Service behaviors is the one I'm talking about here. And underneath service behaviors, you can have one or more behavior, as long as you have one that matches whatever your services are expecting to find. And some things are, I don't think there's any additional attributes. I think everything is done with additional tags. So this is the syntax for assigning them. And everything here, though I don't have time to show you, everything here from the binding configuration stuff to the service behavior stuff, everything is configurable programmatically as well. Everything has a corresponding object model. You can do all of this 100% from code at your host and not have anything in the configuration file at all, have no config file whatsoever. So here's an example of attributes declaring for service behavior. We have a service behavior attribute, and here's an example of one usage. I want to change the way this service is instantiated to a per-call situation instead of a per-session, which I'll talk about later. So I change a variable equal to something else, but I'm using the service behavior attribute. I don't have a T-shirt to throw at them. So service debugging is the first example I'm going to show you for a service behavior, okay? By default, a service doesn't pass error details to a client. So you may have some initial information needed just during your development cycle, which you can turn off later. Because remember, the more information you receive on the client about what took place on the service, the more information is traveling on the wire. That's common sense. How did I get this? Because the service sent it to me. So by default, the service is sending you minimal information. And there's a setting that I'm going to show you how to use that helps you debug your services a little better. This service is called Include Exception Details in False. I think there's a race on the Microsoft campus to see who can come up with the longest names possible. I mean, they're getting to be, what, 25 characters now. Holy cow. So look at this one. We got inside the behavior tag, we have an additional tag called Service Debug. And every behavior is different. So there may be 15 different kinds of these things. I can't show you all of them. So I have one called Service Debug, and one of its attributes, the one that's important for me today, to me today, is Include Exception Details in False, and it defaults to false. I'm going to set it to true. Now, I can do this one either or. Some behaviors are only available one way, some available another way. This one happens to be available through either declarative tagging or at the service. I can hard code this on the service, meaning in my service class, I can have a service behavior, I can have the service behavior attribute, and one of the arguments that I can set is include exception details in false. I can set that to true. Now I've locked this service into sending exception details through the wire if something blows up. And even if you try to turn it off to false here, it's going to still send them through because you've locked it in code. So this may be an option for you. I personally like to have them here because I set this to true during my development cycle, and then I set it back to false when I deploy to production. Because fault handling the right way is a whole other topic that we don't have time to cover today. And if you do fault handling the right way, your client will get the information they need without excessive travel of information through the wire. No, there is nothing that says localhost only. You had to turn it on and turn it off. Let me show you a little demo on this one. We had 112 people listening around the world, or around the country, I guess. I don't know where they are. Hey, for those of you that are remote, feel free to, I'd love to know where some of you are calling in from, especially if you're overseas, outside the U.S. So send me an email on my email that's kind of all over this session slide, just telling me where you are. I'd just love to kind of get a little bit of a rough idea as to where people are calling in from. Okay, so let's go over to the services here. And my service doesn't have anything on it. And my app config on my host, where's my host? I'm going to set the behavior to false, and my client is gonna, it's a service behavior, it's not on the client, only on the service. So let's go ahead and run this. You can see the difference. Okay, so I'm gonna go ahead and say test debugging, and it's gonna blow up now. And as you can see, look at this rather wonderful message that came up here. No, this is not the one. Sorry. This is the one. It doesn't really tell as much. In fact, it's recommending that we turn on include exception details in false. So once again, it knows the right parentheses is missing. Everybody understand that analogy, right? Now, if I go over to view detail, you can see that all I got is a conventional system service model fault exception. I got no inner exception. I got no information here whatsoever. Now, I do want to show you what I threw. I threw a divide by zero exception. Now, I won't get that information. In order to get the actual exception, I have to do fault handling the WCF way, which is an hour-long topic on its own. But I did send a manual. I did send my own custom message. I would like to at least see that. So I'm going to go into the config file, and I'm going to change this to true, and look what the difference is now. Right? You know what? I started up the original one without debugging, so it was still running. Hang on. Down here. Yep, there it is. There we go. Okay, hit F5. There we go. Test debugging. And now I get a little bit more information that may or may not be important to me. See? So I got my message at least. This at least tells me where the exception is because I'm the one that wrote that message. Now, it doesn't tell me anything else about details of that exception. That has to be done in a fault handling way, but yeah. Say that again. And you have to do that in WCF's way, but that's WCF fault handling, and that's so the question. The question was, he's actually asking a question in the form of a statement. He says in conventional web services, you have to define what exceptions are expected as part of your design. Is that what you're asking? Okay, and why didn't I do that? Well, if I was teaching you a whole hour-long session on WCF fault and exception handling, that's exactly what I would be doing. I have to define fault contracts. I have to tell the services what exceptions to expect. I have to raise these fault exceptions of T. There's the whole topic, proper fault handling. But that's not what I'm doing here. I don't have time to show you that today. So I'm showing you the quick and dirty way of getting just that little bit more information to the client when an exception is thrown. Make sense? Cool. But good question. All right. All right. So I believe that this is the end of this solution, and there's going to be another solution. So let me go back to the slides. Okay. I'm really looking forward to showing you the WCF 4.0 stuff at the end of the day. There's some cool features that I got really excited about. I'll take one question. Huh? No, I'm not showing you message contracts. Message contracts are not as commonly used as you may think. They have a very specific usage. They take data contracts to a level of detail that most developers do not need. So, yeah. What service factory are you referring to? Okay. And the gentleman asked a question of why am I not using message contracts or what are message contracts? And I told my response was message contracts are not commonly used for everyday WCF development. Don Demsack in the back there gave a couple of valid exceptions. It's when you want to use message contracts, and unfortunately, that's what we got to leave it at. However, Don has significantly more knowledge about message contracts than I do. He uses them more often than I do. I've used them very, very little, and I try to shy away from them unless I have a specific reason to use them. So if you want real reasons why you use them, I suggest you trap him during lunch. Don't let him eat. Just corner him and ask him all the questions you want and make sure you keep asking him questions until lunch is over or until I've eaten everything. All right? But yeah, Don's used message contracts. I know you guys use them at Telago quite often. So I steer away from them just because I can. I don't need to. Okay, instancing. Now it gets fun. Instancing is concurrency. I want to once again stress that these are two massive topics, okay? It takes me 3/4 of a day to fully go over every detail of both of these topics, and they're both kind of intertwined. There's instancing controls how a service is served up, how it's instantiated, literally instantiated and served to a client. There's three different modes. There's per call, per session, and singleton. Singleton has its uses, okay? Singleton is not that negative. Everybody, the minute you bring the word singleton into a conversation, people are like, oh, it's the simplest of design patterns. You never want to use that. Singleton has very good reasons for being used. So per call, I'll describe all three of these things, okay? A per call service. Every call to the service. Now, that statement is to be taken literally. You're a client. You instantiate a proxy. You made a call. That's a call. You use that same proxy. You make a call again. That's a call. You instantiate a new proxy. You make a call. That's the call. You're another client with your own proxy. You make a call. That's the call. Every call gets a different instance of this service. I want to stress that literally because in the case of instantiating a proxy and making multiple calls to that proxy before you don't use it anymore, if you're set to a per-call service, every proxy call, every call to the service is going to be on a totally new instance of that service class, which means the constructor gets called every single time on that service class. Everybody understand that? It's no different than newing up the proxy all over again. There is no state management. You're responsible for it, which means there is no in-memory state unless you're using static resources, in which case you better handle locking pretty well. Okay? But yes, that's an excellent follow-up statement to what I just said because one of the first things people say, oh, wait a minute, that means that any variables that I set, maybe class-wide variables of that service that I set, they're going to be reset when the next call comes in? Absolutely. You cannot use in-memory variables unless they're static to hold state. Yes? Are you what? Prevent? Throttling. I'm not going to talk about throttling, man. I can't. You're hitting me with a totally different topic from this, completely out of left field. There throttling is possible. So the gentleman asked, how do you prevent throttling, you said? So throttling is a capability of WCF. There are some throttling defaults. Throttling is the ability to manage the settings in which WCF can handle multiple calls and multiple concurrency so it doesn't get overburdened, so it doesn't stretch until it snaps. You can set settings so it throttles back. So if the service is set to only handle maybe 100 calls and 200 and 101 come in, that one is kind of queued up waiting for another one to finish up before it gets put in there. All of that is configurable, but it's not something I'm going to talk about now. But the settings do exist, and they're very powerful. So everything gets a new instance, same client, different clients, no matter. It is the most scalable and fastest setting. I think that goes without saying. And it's actually my recommendation for your services as a point of start. Because it is completely scalable. Everything's on its own instance. And plus, you have no concurrency issues because everything is on its own instance. Yes, one question. Does instancing depend on the host? No, completely host independent. Instancing depends on the service. I'm going to show you how it's configured now. But remember, we started this by starting the topic of service behaviors. Service behaviors are at a per service level. So instancing is done at a per service level. How that service is hosted needs to be irrelevant because today may be hosted one way, tomorrow may be hosted another way. I had one guy online that asked me, why do I want to use self-hosting instead of IIS? Well, I have my reasons today, but tomorrow I may change my mind and go IIS. I don't want to change my service, just the hosting. Okay, and as this gentleman said, you cannot count on service date. That's very important there. And upon call completion, the dispose is called. So if your service happens to implement the disposable pattern, you can do some housekeeping there if that's important to you. Not required. Per session, this is the default. So everything we've written today so far has been a per session service. Per session means every proxy instantiation gets a new instance of the service. So the constructor is called on the first operation. This is really kind of similar to regular newing up objects, except that the constructor is called when you new up the object instead of on the first method operation. Here, the constructor is called on the first operation call, and so long as you're using that same proxy, you're accessing the exact same instance of that service. Your host is actually hanging on to that service for you. This is the most analogous to regular object newing up. I have to look at this side of the room more often. I really apologize to you guys. I kind of keep doing this because I'm using this screen. And that one's way the heck over there, so I apologize to you guys. I'm going to ignore you guys for a while. So But see, the screen, I'm looking at the screen here. One question. It doesn't. Okay, so he's asking how does the client, I saw that question coming. That's why I didn't even let you finish. How does the client know how the service is being serviced? The client has no clue. No clue. This is a complete service behavior. The client doesn't know. The client will only know if the client is expecting something to happen a certain way and it doesn't happen that way, like the maintenance of state. Okay? So you can use, for this gentleman here, I have to look back at this. So for this gentleman here, you can save state in class-wide variables now. Because as long as you keep that proxy open, you're handling the same one. Yes. Yes. One more question. Okay. Thanks. Okay. Singleton is the last instancing mode. Singleton, one instance serves all proxies for all clients. Exactly what it sounds like. This is the quintessential singleton pattern right out of our favorite pattern catalog, right? The host can just do the hosting the way I've already taught you with a type of, or the host can actually receive a running instance of the service. The state can be shared among clients. This is important, which means if something is held in a class-wide variable in that service and another client around the world calls that service, they can access this variable. It's one instance literally for everybody. Very specific use on this one. Yes, sir. Say that again. The same running instance. That means that when this service is first called by its first client, WCF mews it up and holds it there. And when somebody else calls in that service, instead of mewing a new instance of the service, it's going to serve that running instance. Well, you're not passing anything around. It's still sitting. No, it's the service itself is sitting in one location only, but you're using that same instance. You're sharing the same instance. So any class-wide variables there are going to be shared by everybody. If I call that service and say and call a method, and that method sets the variable I to 10, and I is declared at the service level, not the method level, when Eric here calls in that method to read I, he's going to read 10 because you set it. One more question, and I got to move on.
Does that mean if the service has to wait until
the server? Say it again?
Does that mean a service has to wait until the server completes the request for the next request?
Well, that's a topic of concurrency. Let me see if I answer that question on the next topic. Okay? It doesn't wait. It may wait to let the next call in, but not necessarily to complete. You understand, concurrency has to do with letting the next call in. So that depending on concurrency settings, even though you're sharing the same instance, based on your concurrency setting, that next call may get to that running instance, but just sit there at the method and wait until this one is done before this one's allowed in. That's based on your concurrency settings. Now, here's what I'm going to do. Notice I have instancing demo. I'm going to go through the concurrency slides because the project that I'm demoing these two features with is called instancing and concurrency. It's one project together. So I want to do it as one, if that's okay with you guys. Okay? I got my little cheat sheet here of things which I can't make heads or tails on anyway. All right, so now the topic of concurrency, another pretty big topic, okay? And we're going to cut it close with this one. We're going to go 5, maybe 7 minutes into lunch. Is that all right with you guys? Sure. Nobody's hungry here anyway.
You got 15 minutes.
Okay.
Is that right?
Get 20 preferably.
No problem. Take your time.
All right. Well, like I said, this is a new talk, and I wrote it specifically for you guys. I went through hell and high water to do this for you guys, and, you know, you always take a risk when you don't have your timings down. Okay, so concurrency controls the way service handles locking during multiple calls to it, okay? And this may be relevant to instancing because during calls to the service, to the instance of the service. Now, if you're set for call, for example, everything's on a different instance, so then concurrency becomes less relevant. It's when things are per session or singleton that instancing becomes more relevant, and you're going to see the effect of that in the demo. Okay, there's three different modes here, and I talk about two of them only, single and multiple. Reentrant has a very specific purpose, and I'll discuss it in a couple of minutes. So single is the default. This is the mode that we've been using the whole time. The service instance, okay, which means whatever instance is being served. And remember, in a per-call situation, it's always a new instance. In a per-session, it may be the same instance if we're making calls on that same proxy. Make sense? In a singleton situation, it's always going to be the same instance, no matter who the proxy is, because this one instance serves all. Do you see how those two topics are kind of interrelated a little bit there? So the service instance allows only one call in at a time. Very, very safe, the absolute safest. And my recommendation for a point to start. WCF will take care of all locking. It will place a lock on the entire service while a call is in progress. It is the default mode and is by far the safest mode. You don't have to worry about any locking and synchronization code on your own. Unlike this monster, multiple concurrency mode. This is the easy way to describe this is WCF gets the hell out of the way and says you're on your own, baby. You have to do everything on your own. What you want to let two calls from the same proxy. Now, same proxy implies same client, so you're going to be pretty safe for multiple clients, unless you're using static resources, of course. But you got the same proxy, as my demo is going to show you, making calls on two threads to the same to the same service. WCF is going to say, sure, come on in. Corrupt my state. Who cares? In which case, you're responsible for all your locking, whether you use a variable locking, whether you want to lock the service instance itself, or whether you want to lock the method at the method level using the attribute, which is actually my preferred method. It's entirely up to you. I'm just giving you examples here. I don't want this to be carried into a locking seminar because it's too big a topic. Did anybody attend Discovery by Wintellect just like last month? Jeffrey Richter was here and did a day of threading. Probably one of the best 8 hours I've ever spent in my life of training. If you've never read Inside the CLR by Jeffrey Richter, there's five chapters in there on threading that are worth their weight in gold. I strongly recommend them. Reentrant concurrency mode has to do, it's very similar to single, but what it has to do with is the ability to call back into that service if you temporarily left it. So if you temporarily left it to either go to another service or maybe to call back to the client in a request response fashion, when you come back into the service, it keeps track of the fact that you are the original caller. So it lets you back in. So it's like single, but if it was single, it wouldn't let you back in because it says a lock is a lock is a lock. And to me, you're just another caller. Reentrant knows that, yeah, you're another caller, but you're the guy that put this lock there in the first place. So let me let you back in. So it's a variation. Okay? All right, let's go to the code here. So let me bring up. Oh, man. I hope I have time to do the transactions demo. I'll have time for the transaction slide. I just hope I have time for the demo. If I don't have time for the demo, I'll give you guys the choice. We'll break for lunch, but I'll stay up here, and I'll be happy to work through the demo if you guys want to just bring your lunch in and eat here. I have no problem with that. I'm here for you today. Did I mention I'm not getting a goddamn dime? I'm being known worldwide. This is being broadcasted. Yeah, this is it's all about branding. Hey, look, man, when Peter gave me the opportunity to do this agenda and kind of spear, I mean, you know, Peter's responsible for the fire starters, but when he gave me the opportunity to spearhead some of this stuff, I jumped on it. I had so much fun putting this together. I was really looking forward to today. Then I walk in and see all you guys, and I regret every minute of it. All right, so let's do per call and single. Okay, per call and single. These are not the defaults. Single is the default, per call is not, but it's the safest. This is my recommendation for the safest because every service gets a new instance and only one is allowed in at a time, which doesn't matter because every call gets a new instance. Look what the code does, okay? I show you when the constructor's called, just for the hell of it, but here's all I'm doing. I'm incrementing a class-wide variable called counter, and I'm showing it to you in a message box. Yes, a message box inside a service. I don't ever want to see anybody do this. This is for my demo only, okay? You do not want to include windows.form inside a service, okay? Yeah, your service is sitting at the server rack in Singapore. Who's gonna run in there to press enter, okay? All right, so let's see what my client does, okay? I don't have to set anything on the app config in the host. Nope, we're cool here. Everything is fine. So let me go ahead and run this. And I have a service running, a lot of firewall. Okay. So here's my instancing test, okay? I'm going to leave the concurrency single for the first three examples. So I'm testing instancing here, per call instancing, okay? Oh, man, thank you. I'm surprised you didn't get that on the screen. You did? I really apologize to the remote people. Let me show that again real quick here. I have a service. It's set to per call, which is not the default, and single concurrency, which is the default. And I'm only going to go through the three instancing modes right now. The service has a class-wide level variable that gets incremented in a method call and shown as in a message box, okay? Which I stress I don't want to see anybody do in the real world. So here's my host and here's my client. Let's take a look at both of these things. I'm going to say instancing test. And as you can see, the constructor gets called and counter is set to 1. Now, what do you think is going to happen on the next one? Constructor called, counter 1. Constructor called, counter 1. The constructor called is the key thing here. This is proof that you're on a new instance every time. Look what the client is doing. I'm using a class-wide proxy. The proxy is declared up here. So I'm not regenerating the proxy. I'm proving to you that this is on one proxy instantiation. I'm calling this method over and over and over again. Now let's go back to the service and let's change this to the default. This is the default right here. I wish that wasn't the case. I prefer the default to be per call, but I'm suspecting that Microsoft wanted to keep the behavior of a service as analogous to a regular object as they want, as they can for its default implementation. So that's why it's per session. That's my guess. Okay. So let's run this again. There's my host. There's my client. Let's move this out of the way. Instancing test. Constructor called. Counter is 1. Now what do you think is going to happen? Is the constructor going to be called again? That's correct. As you can see, I'm able to maintain state now. And the constructor is not called over and over again. Yes? I keep proxy open like a regular object until it falls out of scope. Completely until it falls out of scope. The proxy is just an object.
I mean, at what point will the client actually hit a new one? If you go,
it doesn't.
2 hours out,
no, it's like it's an object. Yeah, you left it. You mean if you were dumb enough to leave the application like that during lunch, you know, and go out to lunch, then. I mean, my recommendation, the question is valid, okay? Let me repeat the question. The question is as long as that proxy open. Think of it as a regular object, okay? You want to scope your objects as minimally as possible. I would never recommend you scoping a proxy to a class level unless you had a very good reason for doing that. I personally prefer to have a button, open a proxy, make a call, and get out of there.
Yeah.
That's just that. You don't, unless the service host recycles. If the host recycles, then your object's gone. And next time you make a proxy call, you may not even get a new one. If your proxy was open on a previous host, it may actually get a communications failure. Okay, so one more here. It's called single. Okay, one more question, guys. No, it's not at a per operation level. If you need to control this at a per operation level, then separate your operations among various service contracts. No, even that won't work. I'm sorry. It has no, because this is not at the service contract level. You have to do different services. No, if you want to control instancing on one operation one way and another operation another way, you have to do it in two different services. So you're talking about probably demarcation or something. That's more of a design thing. Why don't you catch me during lunch and we can talk about that? Okay? Thanks. All right, so I got single here. So let's do single. Now, constructor was just called. As soon as that host started up, it called the constructor. It instantiated the service. Now it has a running instance waiting to receive calls. I'm going to call instancing test, and this says one. I'm going to call it again. It says two. But watch what I'm going to do now. I'm going to start yet another instance of my client. So I got two clients now, man. Look at this. This is great. One, two, there we go. So let's call instancing here. We got counter three. Here's another guy around the world. Four, two completely different clients, all sharing the same instance of that service. That's a singleton instance. Okay? All right, now, you've just seen an example of concurrency. There is no concurrency problems here. If I put this back, let's put this back on a per call. And let me show you some client code, because I'm going to do a concurrency test here. The concurrency test I'm going to do takes that existing proxy, and it makes the call inside a spun-up thread. So look at that code. It spins up the thread and makes the call to the method on a separate thread other than the foreground thread. Everybody understand that? That's the purpose of that demo. Now, here's the important thing, okay, because this will really shoot you in the butt if you don't remember it, and I can tell you this from experience because I stayed up late last night remembering this from a previous demo. The first call to a proxy establishes thread affinity. So if I do not do this, then the thread that this proxy, which is declared up here, the thread that this proxy is going to belong to, guess what thread that's going to be? The one that I spun up. And the results are going to be different. So what I want to do here is that I'm opening the proxy manually. This proxy.open lets me establish thread affinity without making an actual call. Now thread affinity is established on my foreground thread, and I can simply make my calls on a background thread. Everybody understand that? Okay? Some of you kind of look glassy-eyed. You're just waiting to finish this and go out and get drunk, aren't you? That's what I'm doing. All right, so let's see what this looks like, okay? Our service is set to per call. Instantiation mode is single. So I'm going to run my same demo once again, but now I'm going to make a call here from this proxy, and I don't have to worry about unique proxy. I'm going to keep the test with the same proxy. That's the purpose of my test. Counter one, constructor called. Counter one, constructor called. Now watch this. I'm going to hit this button, hit it again, hit it again, hit it again. It's waiting for me to finish this before it lets the next one in, and then the next one, and then the next one. Okay? Now let's change this now to multiple, and I'm probably going to skip singleton because I do want to cover some of transaction. So now we're allowing ourselves to do multiple. You know what? Because I'm doing multiple, let's do some locking here. So I'm going to synchronize this entire method, which means this is going to be totally thread-safe code, only one thread allowed in. However, the call is going to let me do it. As you can see, let me do it. So it's still a different instance. That's why the counter is always one, because it's per call. But it let me make it. It let me make the call. Now, if I take that one step, see, where it gets really confusing is when you start mixing and matching these things. So I got a great set of diagrams for you that will really help you out. Compliments of Michelle Bustamante from iDesign, who has them in her book, and Juval doesn't have them in his. He should. Now, it's per session, so it's the same instance. But notice it didn't let me do what I did. Now watch this. The minute I do this, Now it lets me in. Why did it have the same effect as if it was per call? Because I synchronized the method. Even though I'm letting multiple calls in, it's a thread-safe method. That's going to become important because you can really shoot yourself in the foot if you don't do this. I mean, with this example, it probably won't matter much. But in code where synchronization becomes very important, it may be an issue for you. So now I can do this. See? All at the same, all in multiple threads while it's in that method. Remember, this message box is sitting. It's sitting at a message box, so it hasn't finished that operation yet. However, it let the other operation in. And the job of that other operation from the other call was to increment the counter and show another message box. So every single call is still sitting at that same message box and waiting to be finished. It just, each one is incrementing a counter that's being shared because we're all in the same instance. And it can get pretty scary here if you don't use synchronization properly. Do you understand the difference though? Does the demo demonstrate the effect of what the difference is? Don't everybody answer it once because that really pisses me off. All right. It is a good, that's what I wanted to hear. It's a good demo. All right. Let me show you the, oh man, I really want to do transactions. So these are the diagrams that I got for you. These things are really, really good, okay? This shows you per call with single concurrency. As you can see, no locking. You need to worry about it. Everything goes on a different service instance. Multiple clients, even the same proxy gets a different service instance. Yet, per session, you're running into the same service instance. So if it's single concurrency, this second call into the same service is going to run into a lock until the first one is over. Singleton, every client is going to get one service. And until T1, until thread one is done, these are all going to run into locks. Once this one's done, this one will be let through. But it's all going to be on a shared instance. And then you got multiple concurrency, which shows you the three different scenarios.
The value of all this is to establish a business process. In other words, depending on how you want to run this stuff.
The value of all this is that you can establish that this.
I mean, in terms of business value, different business processes, right?
Charles, you really piss me off sometimes. No, I don't understand what you're saying. I mean, I understand your English, but I don't understand exactly what you're asking. No, I'm serious. No, I don't laugh at Charles, man. I don't reckon.
You can substitute a business process.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, the message box was just an example for me to show you what's happening behind the scenes. I don't ever want to catch wind that anybody put a message box inside a service or an object for that matter.
Workflow.
Absolutely. Of course it's going to be workflow. Absolutely. So my best practices recommendation here before we move on to transactions is to include exception details during development. So the include exception details equals true. Use that during development. Turn it off later. Use per call for all your services, which you're going to have to remember to do because it's not the default. Per session is the default. Introduce per session or singleton if the scenario calls for it. If you need state handling for specific reasons, per session is great. If you need state handling at a worldwide scope, then singleton is great, but start with per call. Definitely start with single concurrency mode and introduce multiple as the situation calls for it, okay? Don't forget, performance increase is a myth when it comes to multi-threaded programming. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise, okay? The fact that you spun off multiple threads to do different things means more often than not you're going to lose performance and not gain it. The reason that people think the opposite is because it's a client perception. When you see more than one thing happening at once, you get the perception that your system is operating in a faster way. When in reality, if you knew the overhead of spinning off threads in .NET, it is massive. And unless your threads are less than or equal to the number of cores in your processor, you're not going to get a true performance benefit. Now, if you got a four-core machine and you spin off four threads, you are going to get true multi-threaded programming, and yes, you're going to go significantly faster. But if you spin off eight cores on a four-core machine, it's a myth and it's a facade, okay? I have this. We'll talk about this later. Okay, so transactions is my last topic. Let me get through the slides and I can do the demo on lunch because we're 5 minutes in already. So WCF itself as a runtime is a fully functioning and qualified transaction manager. And by that, I mean that like SQL Server, it adheres to industry accepted and industry set transaction protocols and transaction technologies, which means it can contribute to existing transactions or spin off new transactions. WCF can be set where transactions can flow into a service from a client, or they can flow from service to service, or a service can start them up themselves. It has automatic participation in the famous two-phase commit that we all read about whenever we read about transaction theory. It has to be enabled on the binding first. This is the master switch. If you don't do this, you don't get any transaction support whatsoever. So the first thing you gotta do is that you gotta set a binding configuration the way I taught you earlier in the hour, which is at the endpoint level, binding configuration equals something, and then set up your binding configuration down here. And it's an attribute off the binding tag called transaction flow equals true. This is your master switch. Once this is set, then you got two primary things you got to worry about. The first one is called transaction flow. And this is an attribute set at the service contract level, not the service level, at the contract level, on the operations, not on the service contract itself. And by default, transactions are not allowed, or should I say transaction flow is not allowed. Transaction flow only implies that this operation is going to allow a transaction to come into it from either another service or a client. So from essentially a client. That client can be another service or it can be a Windows app or whatever, but a transaction can come into it. By default, it's not allowed. You set it to allowed. That's my recommended setting. You can set it to be mandatory. That means that this method will not work unless it has an existing ambient transaction to which it can participate, in which it can participate. It will not be able to start its own. This is mandatory. The other part of transaction handling is at the service operation, not the service contract operation, but the operation itself on the service implementation code. You can use the operation behavior attribute. And you have this, it's called transaction flow. I can't remember. It's in the next slide. It's transaction scope required. Transaction scope required can be set to either true or false. And this will, if it's true, the operation will either participate in the incoming transaction based on the flow setting, or if there is no existing transaction, it starts one on its own, which is very, very cool. No code necessary here. Forget about that transaction scope equals new transaction scope. You can do all that manual stuff, but number one, I'm not here to teach that. Number two, it's not necessary. It really isn't. If it's false, this operation will not participate in a transaction. So this is what it looks like. We have the update contact. We set transaction flow to allowed after we turned on that master switch. And then I'm going to go pay attention to these folks. And then we have, see, I can do this. I can stand here. And then we have the service, which implements the contract, and here we're setting transaction scope required equals true. So if a transaction came into this method, it will be used by this method. If a transaction did not come in from the outside, then the beginning of this method would immediately spin off a new transaction. And from there forward, everything inside this method, this operation, should I say, will be included inside a new transaction. And that includes calls to down-level business layer. So you could be calling three or four different business engines here, or a data access engine, or entity framework, or whatever you want, and it's all going to be scoped within that transaction. Is that nice? The commit will happen. That's an excellent question. The commit will happen automatically upon successful completion of the method. No, not at all. The rollback will happen automatically upon a fault and exception handling, or exception happening. Make sense? Now, there are manual ways of tweaking this stuff, which are beyond the scope of this session. I'm here to teach you what's the name of this session, the most common usage configuration. So this is a way to, I mean, what I've shown you right now with this slide, even without the demo, this is what I recommend you do all the time. And go ahead. Absolutely. Does it exist? So the question is, does that include persisting the data in the database? Absolutely. And if you want to stick around during lunch for the demo, I'll prove that to you. Absolutely. Because WCF is a transaction resource. SQL Server is a transaction resource. Both of these technologies adhere to industry-accepted transaction protocols, which means they both speak the same transaction language. There is an underlying protocol here that WCF might have started And when SQL Server goes to write out to a stored procedure or something or to a table, it sees, hey, WCS somebody, it doesn't care who it is, somebody provided me with a transaction. Let me just add my stuff to this transaction and then vote yay or nay on it. Remember, it's about voting. The source of that transaction ends up committing or rolling back based on everybody that voted down the line. Say what? What if the database is Oracle? What if the database is Oracle? What do you think is going to happen? Do you think Larry Ellison was a fool? He may hate Microsoft, but the man's not an idiot. Oracle is a fully functional transaction manager as well. So is Sybase. So is MySQL. These are all, I mean, part of putting something out on the market like this, you know, nobody's going to put a database out there and say, oh, but it doesn't work with transactions. That'd be a big no-no. I'm sure there are some, but, and in order for them to work with transactions, they just can't handle them their own way. They have to adhere to transaction protocols that everybody agreed to work on. And if you want to know about those protocols, I'm the wrong guy to ask. Because this is what I do with transactions, what I'm showing you right here. One more question. How do you detect success or failure? Well, if your client came back from this call with no error, that indicates success. Dude, did you expect me to say anything else? But seriously, it really is as common sense oriented as that. All right, I'll take a couple more questions because I've agreed to do the demo during lunch. So, gentlemen in the back.
We should break for lunch.
Oh, then one more. Say what? WCF is not a coordinator. WCF is going to require DTC, just like SQL Server requires DTC. Absolutely, yeah. Let me, with no more questions for now, let me just add to this. So he asked if WCF a transaction coordinator. No, it's a transaction manager. It's a transaction, well, transaction resource or a transactional resource. There is three different transaction coordinators on your system. There's the lightweight transaction manager, LTM. There's the kernel transaction manager, KTM. And there's distributed transaction coordinator. Transaction always starts at the LTM level, and it escalates to the next one based on necessity, and that is completely outside the scope of your control. What you do want to make sure is that count on DTC being needed 99% of the time, so make sure that DTC, Distributed Transaction Coordinator, which is included in everybody's box, make sure it's turned on, which is just a Windows admin service. As long as that's turned on, DTC handles the distribution of all that, and it goes from box to box and everything. So, not that I know of, and if there is, I don't know how to do it. All right, so listen, we're going to break for lunch, but I'm going to stay here, and I'll be happy to work through the demo with you guys. Okay. All right.
Okay. So, for everyone here in New York, we're going to take a break for lunch. But what I ask for everyone in the room is to please exit out to your right. Do not go out the doors here on the left side. Head out to the right side and walk around and form two lines. There is pizza outside. We ask that you take only two slices at first until everyone gets a chance. We will.
That means you, Don.
We will be starting the next session at 1 p.m. Eastern time, but Miguel will do the transaction demo during lunch if you optionally wish to come back with your pizza in about 10 minutes. For those of you who are on the online session, we are going to leave the audio up so you can hear the dialogue going on here in New York, but we are going to pause the recording until the transaction demo starts. So the rest session will start at 1 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, I'm glad you
Thank
brought
you.
It up. I'm going to mention it. Thanks. Okay, so your compact framework is only allowing basic HTTP? Really? Okay. Well, then good luck with sub-second response. Here they are. All right, so I want to kick off these questions that are here.
Answer them live.
Okay. So the first question that I have is how long is the session kept on the WCF server when the service's behavior is set to per session? So that's going to depend on your hosting. And if I recall correctly, when you're doing self-hosting, your session is open as long as if that client is still active, if you haven't disposed of your proxy, you still got an open connection there. If you're using IIS for hosting, then you're going to be subject to potential session recycling that IIS can or may not do. We all know that IIS, number one, there's a session state limit of, 20 minutes, I think, in regular IIS web hosting. So inactivity will time out a session after 20 minutes. Also, there is a the potential of somebody redeploying the site or changing a config file. Everybody here has experienced that if you change the config, the web config, on a running site, as soon as you hit that website again, it recycles to the default ASPX no matter where you went. It's, it sets everything back to default. So that's going to depend on your hosting there. Mircea is asking, can I roll back by raising an error? Well, that's exactly how you roll back. The throwing of an exception, whether you threw one yourself or it caused or an exception happened in the method, will cause this transaction to not complete. The success of the operation without any fault, and I use the term fault instead of exception because I'm trying to keep the WCF terminology, and we call them faults. So the success of an operation without a fault is going to imply the success of the transaction, or at least the success of the voting for that method. Keep in mind, this transaction may be open two levels up, and there's other methods that need to vote on it. So the transaction may still fail, even though your particular method succeeded. Keep that in mind. Do we have to provide rollback methods? No, you do not. That's the beauty of using WCF for transaction handling, as you're going to see here. I'm going to show you a demo where I'm going to run something without transactions whatsoever. You're going to see what the effects are when I fail it. And then you're going to see what the effects are where I fail it when I do turn on transaction support. So, no, you do not have to provide the rollback. Can you imagine what a pain in the butt that would be to have to write rollback functionality? Oh, that would be probably the single biggest reason for the existence of transaction managers to begin with. So Bobby is asking, allowing me to ask a question before the programming session. Okay, I hope I can't read the whole thing. Do you have a
question to read?
Oh, there we go. So, we won't discuss this outside this room. Okay, I'm using the REST starter kit and programming RESTful services in CTV2 on 3.5. Is Microsoft going to release that kit without forcing me to migrate to .NET 4? The most I can answer on this question before I pass it off to Peter is that, to the best of my knowledge, everything in the REST starter kit has been included in 4. So if you're using WCF 4, you have pretty much the REST starter kit. Now, if you're not using 4,
not everything?
Well, not everything has been included, you're saying? Oh, okay. Well, that's news to me. So, do you want to handle that entire question?
I don't know the answer. We'll have to get back to you.
Okay, we'll have to get back to you, Bobby. Sorry about that. That's what you get for asking a premature question, Bobby. Okay, can we get a real-world example for each instancing type? Well, to the best of my knowledge, we did, didn't we? Yeah, we did a real-world example. But if you'd like me to repeat that demo. Shoot away another Q&A saying you'd like me to repeat that demo, and I will do so during this lunch hour before I cannot eat into the next speaker's time. But shoot me another Q&A if you'd like me to repeat that demo. Richard's asking, can I run a scheduled process within my WCF service? I don't see a reason why you can't. I'd probably want to kick it off in such a way where it doesn't rely on that on that operation holding. In other words, I may have a WCF service with an operation, and then the operation is designed to kick off a process. But the caller will immediately get a response. The way I would want to design it is for the caller to get a response that, yes, the process is kicked off, not wait for that process to finish. In which case, the job of the service would be to kick something off, whether it's maybe throwing it into a service queue that another service picks up on and then returning immediate control to the original client, or some other technique. You're at your own for programmatically taking care of that. But your service can kick off whatever it wants. Queuing is actually a perfect solution for this because I can have a service designed to, say, turn on or kick off the following process. And the job of that service is to do a long-running process. But rather than that service code kicking off another one, I can have that long-running process in the service code and just make the call using queuing, using message queuing, MSMQ, which means that now the client's effect will be to make the operation, since all queued calls by definition have to be one-way calls, no request response is allowed, the client will simply make a one-way call, which is literally a fire and forget, and now the call is running away. However long it takes that call to complete, it doesn't matter. It's out of the client's concern. And that would essentially be what you're trying to do here. If you want to do, you could always do something more fancy where you can have other operations that test the progress of that process, in which case it's up to your process code to update some kind of state somewhere that another service can read from on a regular basis to determine whether it's completed or not. In a way, that's how, think about Microsoft Home. Anybody use Microsoft Home Server here? Okay, Home Server is like one of the best products to ever come out of Redmond. I mean, this thing is fantastic. Me and Peter can't stop talking about it anytime we're having a beer together. The conversation always seems to come back into either Home Server or Media Center, right? Fantastic product. It's nothing more than as a backup server. If you're a guy that has only one machine at home and that's it, definitely have a Home Server sitting on your desk, because just for backups, it's worth its weight in gold. But in Home Server, you use a console because it's a headless machine. So you use a console application, which is graphical in nature, and it's on your desktop or any of your desktops. And you bring that thing up, and you say, back up my machine or back up any machine on my network. Well, when you kick that off, you're not waiting for the backup to complete. You kick it off, and you can close the console. Then you can open the console an hour later and see the status of your backup because it's still running. So it's essentially the concept that I'm talking about here, the situation that I'm talking about. It's up to the backup process to constantly update a percentage flag somewhere where the console, the Home Server console, could come back in at any time and check that progress. And I know, Eric, you're a big Home Server fan, too. You're actually the one that convinced – he's the one that convinced me to go the HP route instead of building my own.
I still built my own.
Okay, you can erase you're going to keep Bobby's question in there so you can answer it later? Okay, and Henry is asking which binding can be used if client using a different language, Java or JavaScript. Don. Oh, can you answer that?
Yeah.
Because I know Don does this.
So if you're doing interoperability with a non-Microsoft client, whether it's Java or JavaScript. Well, if it's JavaScript, you're going to be doing RESTful-style programming, which we'll talk about in the next session. If you've got a plain old Java client, basically the web binding, the SOAP and WSDL binding that gives you the basic profiling stuff works. You can also, I believe, depending on which Java stack you're using, turn on and enable all the other things like the security, reliable messaging, and transaction. You can get those levels, too, with those bindings, depending on which stack you're using on the other side. That about handles that.
Thank you. I'm sorry if I'm chewing into the microphone here, but this is New York and this is pizza, and those two things go together, so I'm enjoying it. And you know what? And this is good pizza, but we know that, right?
Yeah.
We know that.
So we'll let Miguel eat his pizza for 2 seconds, and then he has 5 minutes, he promised, to do the transaction demo.
I know I'm supposed to be – I know I'm supposed to keep this one clean, but you're a real son of a bitch, you're not? All right. So let's do that. So let me show you a little database that I have here. You know, I created a database once for a demo in front of it. I just created an arbitrary. It was an empty database, had nothing in it, but it was called Porn Stuff. I just wanted to see. Nobody caught on to it. I had 100 people in the room. Nobody pointed out that I had a database called Porn Stuff. I just did it to see if somebody catches on to it. All right. So transaction sample. Check this out. Very, very simple. Account. It's got an ID, a person name, and a balance. Let me show you what the code, what the data in here looks like, because that's what's going to be relevant to this demo. Okay, so here's Miguel Castro and Peter Laudetti, and we each have $1,000 in our bank account. And for this demo, Peter's going to be a very generous individual. All right? So as you can see, it's $1,000. Now, let's take a look at what my service stuff is. So I got two services here, and somebody asked me earlier if I want to, you know, call this from the client in one transaction because I maybe debited an account, credited an account, so I want that transaction to start at the client. Who asked me that? Who brought that up? That was you, right? Okay, so I have a service here, and this service has two methods. One's called debit account, which receives an account ID and an amount, and all it does is write some, you know, mundane SQL code, because I didn't want to write a whole data access layer for this, to call a stored procedure called debit account. And the other one is called credit account, and it has account ID and amount, and it calls a stored procedure called credit account. And those stored procedures are very, very simple. In fact, they're practically identical. And as you can see here, the stored procedures are going to, the credit account is adding the amount I'm putting into the balance, and the other one is identical, except it subtracts it, subtracts the amount. So one's designed to edit it, to debit an account, and the other one's to credit an account, okay? So simple enough. That's what my service does. This service does that. But this gentleman, what's your name?
Rajin.
Okay, Rajin was correct. If you want to perform a banking transaction, it's always T accounting, right? You're debiting one account, crediting another, right? So I want to make sure that this occurs in one transaction. So I have two ways of doing it. And I'm going to show you my preferred way. I'm not going to show you the other way. But the other way is what you spoke of, which is your client is going to be responsible for this. Your client, if this is the only service I'm exposing, then obviously my client's going to have to make two calls, one to debit account, to debit one account, and one to credit the other account, right? So the client's going to have to make those two calls, and for those two calls to be in the same transaction, the client has to initiate the transaction. So the client starts a transaction. It flows into the first call. The call contributes to the transaction. It comes back to the client. The second call is made under that same transaction. The call is made. It votes on the transaction. Then when the client finishes, the client commits the transaction. The job is done. Everybody's comfortable. The world's a happy place, right? That's one way of doing it. The way I like to do it is this way. I created yet another service. Because at the same time, I can teach you calling one service from another. Teach you to kill two birds with one stone here. So I got one service that implements a service contract called iAccount Manager, which has one operation called transfer funds. Transfer funds has a from account and a to account with an amount. Now this becomes my client because this service is going to call the other one. See? This service now becomes a client of that other service. There's my proxy right there. This is no different than my form calling the service. Just happens to be that one service is a client of another now. So there's my proxy. I'm calling debit account and I'm calling credit account. Same amount, two different accounts. Make sense? This last argument that I had there, I had that for the, are you starting at 1 or 12:45?
1.
Okay, so I'll finish in 5 minutes, don't worry. So here's cause error. This is just something I had to help me out so that if I send a true into there, I'm going to go ahead and blow this process up after I've debited this account but before I credit it. And that's the first sample that I'm going to show you. So does the setup for this demo make sense to you guys? So let me show you real quick what the host looks like because I got this host here that's going to be hosting both my services. So look what the host looks like. And for the remote listener that was talking about naming conventions of my host because he didn't like that I called my variable host, he thought it should be something more descriptive. I 100% agree with you. Here's an example of me hosting two services, and I'm calling them host my service and host account manager. So two different service host instance. And because we have more than one service, we're going to have to add some to the configuration. So here's the configuration. Let me hide this. So here's my service. Here's another service, account manager. Each one has its own endpoint. Okay? My client is going to be very, very simple. My client is going to test with failure or test without failure. And the test with failure is simply, they're both going to call the exact same method. There we go. The difference is the second one is going to send a true into that cause error argument, so I can throw that exception. just so I don't have to change code. I thought it was a slick way of doing it. I can sweat on command.
I swear to God.
You should have seen me in New Orleans. I grabbed the gym towel from the hotel. I'm walking down Bourbon Street with this white towel on my ass. All right. So I'm going to transfer from account one to account two, $100. Let's do this without any transactions, okay? As you can see, I got everything commented out. My contracts, everything's commented out there. There we go. Okay? So you saw what the data was, $1,000. Let's go ahead and run this. And let's test it without failure first. And now I'm going to go back to here. And I'm going to view it. And as you can see, Miguel has 100. Actually, Miguel was the one that was generous. I'm sorry. So, Peter, you're richer than I am now. So, Miguel's got 900 bucks. Peter's got 1,100. Let's put that back where it's just easier for us to read and do the demo. And because I'm not going to let him get away with this. So Peter's got $1,000. I got $1,000 again, right? So let's do the following now. Okay, now I'm going to test with failure. Error took place because I'm trapping it and I'm showing the message. Okay? So let's go ahead and close it up. Now Miguel's got $900. So it was deducted from my account, but it wasn't put into Peter. So he's not any richer. He still has $1,000. I'm the one that kind of screwed $100 here. But you see what took place? So I blew it up right in the middle. I debited my account, but then I blew up the system before I credited Peter's account. The system is now in an inconsistent state. You see where that term comes from now? I'm going to put it back at $1,000. And now I'm actually going to turn on the allowing of transaction flowing into those methods. Same thing in this one. I think I have it already turned on at the binding. No, I do not. So I'm going to come over here to the binding, and I'm going to say transaction flow equals true. And I'm going to go to my client, and in the binding, because it's a binding configuration, has to be done on both sides, I'm going to set transaction flow equals true. This is my master switch. Now I've turned on flow at the contracts. Now I got to go to the service.
Hold on, I got to reshare your desktop back.
Oh.
My bad.
Wait, but was it shared the whole time before?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Oh.
I accidentally took it off.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
No problem. All right, so now I'm going to go to the service, and I'm going to say transaction scope required on these methods. Now, my client was not calling debit account and credit account. The first service was. So that first service, which is right here, is going to find that the client did not start a transaction. There was no incoming transaction. So the existence of this, transaction scope required, is going to make this hit to the transfer fund. Turn on a transaction, establish an ambient transaction. Now, when debit account and credit account are called, which means when it gets to here, it sees the transaction scopes required, which means this method is going to need a transaction. And because at the contract level, I allowed it to flow in, that existing transaction that transfer funds started will flow into here. And this will occur in that same transaction. And when it calls credit account, it'll go in the same transaction. So now that it's all turned on, let's do the exact same test. One button and the test is over. I'm going to test with failure here, okay? Now, you saw what happened when I tested with failure before. It took money from me and did not give it to him. So it was 900 and 1,000. Now it says error took place. Drum roll, please. Everything's still at 1,000. Done completely declaratively and aspect oriented, if you want to call it that, whatever you want to, whatever terminology you want to use for attribute decoration. But there is no, for those of you guys that were concerned about how do I commit, how do I roll back, I didn't do anything. I didn't change any code. The last thing I want to say about transactions is don't think because common sense will tell you that if your methods are only for the retrieval of information, they're not going to need to be transactional aware. And transactions, for somebody that asked me earlier, they do add performance overhead. Make no mistake about that. But it's just the cost of life that we live with. End of story. However, you may think that a get method does not require a transaction. Today it may not, but a lot of my clients are real sticklers to audit trails and logging and stuff, and they even want to audit trail when a retrieval was made. In which case, you may want a transaction to scope that. If that retrieval fails, maybe you don't want to log that information. Or maybe you do. I don't know. It's a business decision. So just keep in mind, normally, retrieval methods don't require transactions, but they may, depending on any of the other associated stuff that you may be doing. And with that, this demo is over. The rest of those slides had nothing else in them. It was just a summary.